gods and defeated warriors. The branches of an immense pine were clearly visible against the night sky. By the time Jotaro reached the top of the rise, the man had seated himself by the roots of the tree and was smoking a pipe. Daizo, no question about it now. A peasant would never carry tobacco with him. Some had been successfully grown domestically, but on such a limited scale that it was still very expensive. Even in the relatively well-off Kansai district, it was considered a luxury. And up in Sendai, when Lord Date smoked, his scribe felt constrained to make an entry in his daily journal. Morning, 3 smokes. Afternoon, 4 smokes. Bedtime, 1 smoke. Financial considerations aside, most people who had a chance to try tobacco found it made them dizzy or even nauseated. Though appreciated for its flavor, it was generally regarded as a narcotic. Jotaro knew that smokers were few. He also knew that Daizo was one of them, for he had frequently seen him drawing on a handsomely made ceramic pipe. Not that this had ever before struck him as strange. Daizo was wealthy and a man of expensive tastes. "What's he up to?" he thought impatiently. Accustomed now to the danger of the situation, he gradually crept closer. Having finished his pipe, the merchant got to his feet, removed his black kerchief, and tucked it into his waist. Then slowly he walked around the pine. The next thing Jotaro knew, he was holding a shovel in his hands. Where had that come from? Leaning on the shovel, Daizo looked around at the night scenery for a moment, apparently fixing the location in his mind. Seemingly satisfied, Daizo rolled aside a large rock on the north side of the tree and began digging energetically, looking neither right nor left. Jotaro watched the hole grow nearly deep enough for a man to stand in. Finally, Daizo stopped and wiped the sweat from his face with his kerchief. Jotaro remained as still as a rock and totally baffled.
"This'll do,"
the merchant murmured softly as he finished trampling down the soft dirt at the bottom of the hole. For an instant, Jotaro had a peculiar impulse to call out and warn him not to bury himself, but he held back. Jumping up to the surface, Daizo proceeded to drag the heavy bundle from the tree to the edge of the hole and undo the hempen cord around the top. At first, Jotaro thought the sack was made of cloth, but now he could see that it was a heavy leather cloak of the sort generals wore over their armor. Inside was another sack made of tenting or some similar fabric. When this was opened, the top of an incredible stack of gold came into view, semi-cylindrical ingots made by pouring the molten metal into half sections of bamboo split lengthwise. There was more to come. Loosening his obi, Daizo unburdened himself of several dozen large, newly minted gold pieces, which had been stuffed into his stomach wrapper, the back of his kimono, and other parts of his clothing. Having placed these neatly on top of the ingots, he tied both containers securely and dropped the bundle into the pit, as he might have dumped the carcass of a dog. He then shoveled the dirt back in, stamped on it with his feet, and replaced the rock. He finished off by scattering dry grass and twigs around the rock. Then he set about transforming himself back into the well-known Daizo of Narai, affluent dealer in herbs. The peasant's garb, wrapped around the shovel, went into a thicket not likely to be explored by passers-by. He donned his traveling cloak and hung his money pouch around his neck in the manner of itinerant priests. As he slipped his feet into his zori, he mumbled with satisfaction,
"Quite a night's work."
When Daizo was out of hearing range, Jotaro emerged from his hiding place and went to the rock. Though he scrutinized the spot carefully, he could discern no trace of what he had just witnessed. He stared at the ground as if at a magician's empty palm.
"I'd better get moving," he thought suddenly. "If I'm not there when he gets back to the inn, he'll be suspicious."
Since the lights of the town were now visible beneath him, He had no trouble setting his course. Running like the wind, he somehow contrived to stay on back roads and keep well out of Daisel's path. It was with an expression of perfect innocence that he climbed the stairs at the inn and entered their room. He was in luck. Skeiji was slumped against the lacquered traveling case, alone and sound asleep. A thin trickle of saliva ran down his chin.
"Hey, Skeiji, you'll catch cold there!"
Purposely, Jotaro shook him to wake him up.
"Oh, it's you, is it?"
drawled Skeiji, rubbing his eyes.
"What were you doing out this late without telling the master?"
"Are you crazy? I've been back for hours. If you'd been awake, you'd have known that."
"Don't try to fool me. I know you went out with that woman from the Sumiya. If you're running around after a whore now, I hate to think what you'll be acting like when you grow up."
Just then, Daizo opened the shoji.
"I'm back,"
was all he said. An early morning start was necessary in order to make Edo before nightfall. Jinnai had his troop, Akemi restored to it, on the road well before sunrise. Daizo, Skeichi, and Jotaro, however, took their time over breakfast and were not ready to leave until the sun was fairly high in the sky. Daizo led the way, as usual, but Jotaro trailed behind with Skeichi, which was unusual. Finally, Daizo stopped, asking,
"What's the matter with you this morning?"
"Pardon?"
Jotaro did his best to appear nonchalant.
"Is something wrong?"
"No, nothing at all. Why do you ask?"
"You look glum. Not like you."
"It's nothing, sir. I was just thinking. If I stay with you, I don't know whether I'll ever find my teacher or not. I'd like to go and look for him on my own, if it's all right with you."
Without a moment's hesitation, Daizo replied,
"It isn't."
Jotaro had sidled up and started to take hold of the man's arm, but now he withdrew his hand and asked nervously,
"Why not?"
"Let's rest here a while," said Daizo,
lowering himself onto the grassy plain for which the province of Musashi was famous. Once seated, he gestured to Skeichi to go on ahead.
"But I have to find my teacher as soon as possible," pleaded Jotaro.
"I told you, you're not going off by yourself."
Looking very stern, Daizo put his ceramic pipe to his lips and took a puff.
"As of today, you're my son."
He sounded serious. Jotaro swallowed hard, but then Daizo laughed, and the boy, assuming it was all a joke, said,
"I couldn't do that. I don't want to be your son."
"What?"
"You're a merchant. I want to be a samurai."
"I'm sure you'll find that Daizo of Narai is no ordinary townsman without honor or background. Become my adopted son, and I'll make a real samurai out of you."
Jotaro realized, with dismay, that he meant what he was saying.
"May I ask why you decided this so suddenly?" the boy asked.
In a trice, Daizo seized him and pinioned him to his side. Putting his mouth to the boy's ear, he whispered,
"You saw me, didn't you, you little bastard?"
"Saw you?"
"Yes, you were watching, weren't you?"
"I don't know what you're talking about. Watching what?"
"What I did last night."
Jotaro tried his best to stay calm.
"Why did you do that?"
The boy's defenses were close to collapse.
"Why were you prying into my private affairs?"
"I'm sorry," blurted Jotaro. "I'm really sorry. I won't tell a soul."
"Keep your voice down. I'm not going to punish you, but in return, you're going to become my adopted son. If you refuse, you give me no choice but to kill you. Now, don't force me to do that. I think you're a fine boy, very likable."
For the first time in his life, Jotaro began to feel real fear.
"I'm sorry," he repeated fervently. "Don't kill me. I don't want to die."
Like a captured skylark, he wriggled timidly in Daizo's arms, afraid that if he really struggled, the hand of death would descend on him forthwith. Although the boy felt his grip to be vice-like, Daizo was not holding him tightly at all. In fact, when he pulled the boy onto his lap, his touch was almost tender.
"Then you'll be my son, won't you?"
His stubbly chin scratched Jotaro's cheek. Though he couldn't have identified it, what fettered Jotaro was an adult masculine scent. He was like an infant on Daizo's knee, unable to resist, unable even to speak.
"It's for you to decide. Will you let me adopt you, or will you die? Answer me, now!"
With a wail, the boy burst into tears. He rubbed his face with dirty fingers until muddy little puddles formed on both sides of his nose.
"Why cry? You're lucky to have such an opportunity. I guarantee you'll be a great samurai when I finish with you."
"But what is it? You're...
"Yes?
I can't say it."
"Out with it. Speak. A man should state his thoughts simply and clearly."
Well, your business is stealing."
Had it not been for the hands resting lightly on him, Jotaro would have been off like a gazelle. But Daizo's lap was a deep pit, the walls of which prevented him from moving.
"Aha!"
chortled Daizo, giving him a playful slap on the back.
"Is that all that's bothering you?"
Yes.
The big man's shoulders shook with laughter.
"I might be the sort of person who'd steal the whole country, but a common burglar or highwayman I am not. Look at Ieyasu or Hideyoshi or Nobunaga. They're all warriors who stole or tried to steal the whole nation, aren't they? Just stick with me, and one of these days you'll understand."
"Then you're not a thief?"
"I wouldn't bother with a business that's so unprofitable."
Lifting the boy off his knee, he said,
"Now stop blubbering, and let's be on our way. From this moment on, you're my son. I'll be a good father to you. Your end of the bargain is that you never breathe a word to anyone about what you think you saw last night. If you do, I'll wring your neck."
Jotaro believed him. The Pioneers. On the day near the end of the fifth month, when Osugi arrived in Edo, the air was steamingly sultry, the way it was only when the rainy season failed to bring rain. In the nearly 2 months since she had left Kyoto, she had traveled at a leisurely pace, taking time to pamper her aches and pains or to visit shrines and temples. Her first impression of the shogun's capital was distasteful.
"Why build houses in a swamp like this?" she remarked disdainfully. "The weeds and rushes haven't even been cleared away yet."
Because of the unseasonable drought, a pall of dust hung over the Takanawa High Road, with its newly planted trees and recently erected milestones. The stretch from Shioiri to Nihonbashi was crowded with ox carts loaded with rocks or lumber. All along the way, new houses were going up at a furious clip.
"Of all the—"
gasped Osugi, looking up angrily at a half-finished house. A gob of wet clay from a plasterer's trowel had accidentally landed on her kimono. The workmen exploded with laughter.
"How dare you throw mud on people and then stand there laughing? You should be on your knees, apologizing."
Back in Miyamoto, a few sharp words from her would have had her tenants or any of the other villagers cowering. These laborers, among the thousands of newcomers from all over the country, barely looked up from their work.
"What's the old hag babbling about?"
a worker asked. Osugi, incensed, shouted,
"Who said that? Why, you—"
The more she sputtered, the harder they laughed. Spectators began to gather, asking each other why the old woman wasn't acting her age and taking the matter in stride. Storming into the house, Osugi seized the end of the plank the plasterers were standing on and yanked it off its supports. Men in buckets full of wet clay clattered to the floor.
You old bitch!
Jumping to their feet, they surrounded her threateningly. Osugi did not flinch.
Come outside!
She commanded grimly as she placed her hand on her short sword. The workmen had second thoughts. The way she looked and carried on, she had to be from a samurai family. They might get into trouble if they weren't careful. Their manner softened noticeably. Observing the change, Osugi declared grandly,
"Henceforward, I'll not countenance rudeness from the likes of you."
With a look of satisfaction on her face, she went out and started up the road again, leaving the spectators to gape at her stubborn, straight back. She was hardly on her way again before an apprentice, his muddy feet grotesquely covered with shavings and sawdust, ran up behind her carrying a bucket of mucky clay, shouting,
"How do you like this, you old witch?"
He slung the contents of his pail at her back.
"Ow!"
The howl did credit to Osugi's lungs, but before she could turn around, the apprentice had vanished. When she realized the extent of the damage, she scowled bitterly and tears of sheer vexation filled her eyes. The merriment was general.
"What are you nincompoops laughing at?"
raged Osugi, baring her teeth.
"What's so funny about an old woman being splattered with grime? Is this the way you welcome elderly people to Edo? You're not even human. Just remember, you'll all be old one day."
This outburst attracted even more onlookers.
"Edo indeed," she snorted. "To hear people talk, you'd think it was the greatest city in the whole country. And what is it? A place full of dirt and filth, where everybody's pulling down hills and filling in swamps and digging ditches and piling up sand from the seaside. Not only that, it's full of riffraff, like you'd never find in Kyoto or anywhere in the West."
Having got that off her chest, she turned her back on the sniggering crowd and went rapidly on her way. To be sure, the city's newness was its most remarkable feature. The wood and plaster of the houses was all bright and fresh. Many building sites were only partially filled in, and ox and horse dung assailed the eyes and nostrils. Not so long ago, this road had been a mere footpath through the rice paddies between the villages of Hibiya and Chiyoda. Had Osugi gone a little to the west, nearer Edo Castle, she would have found an older and more sedate district, where daimyo and vassals of the shogun had begun building residences soon after Tokugawa Ieyasu occupied Edo in 1590. As it was, absolutely nothing appealed to her. She felt ancient. Everyone she saw, shopkeepers, officials on horseback, samurai striding by in basket hats, all were young, as were laborers, craftsmen, vendors, soldiers, even generals. The front of one house, where plasterers were still at work, bore a shop sign, behind which sat a heavily powdered woman, brushing her eyebrows as she awaited customers. In other half-finished buildings, people were selling sake, setting up displays of dry goods, laying in supplies of dried fish. One man was hanging out a sign advertising medicine.
"If I weren't looking for someone," Osugi mumbled sourly, "I wouldn't stay in this garbage dump a single night."
Coming to a hill of excavated dirt blocking the road, she halted. At the foot of a bridge crossing the as-yet waterless moat stood a shanty. Its walls consisted of reed matting held in place by strips of bamboo, but a banner proclaimed that this was a public bath. Osugi handed over a copper coin and went in to wash her kimono. After cleaning it as well as she could, she borrowed a drying pole and hung the garment up by the side of the shanty. Clothed in her underwear, with a light bathrobe draped over her back, she squatted in the shadow of the bathhouse and gazed absently at the road. Across the street, half a dozen men stood in a circle, haggling in voices loud enough for Osugi to hear what they were saying.
"How many square feet is it? I wouldn't mind considering it if the price is right."
"There's 2/3 of an acre," The price is what I mentioned before. I can't come down from that.
That's too much. You must know that yourself.
Not at all. It costs a lot of money to fill in land. And don't forget, there's no more available around here.
Oh, there must be. They're filling in everywhere.
Already sold. People are snatching it up as it is, swamp and all. You won't find 300 square feet for sale. Of course, if you're willing to go way over toward the Sumida River, you might be able to get something cheaper.
Do you guarantee there's 2/3 of an acre?
You don't have to take my word for it. Get a rope and measure it off yourself.
Osugi was astounded. The figure quoted for 100 square feet would have been sufficient for tens of acres of good rice land. But essentially, the same conversation was taking place all over the city, for many a merchant speculated in land. Osugi was also mystified.
Why would anybody want land here? It's no good for rice, and you can't call this place a city.
By and by, the deal across the street was sealed with a ritual hand-clapping intended to bring good luck to all concerned. As she idly watched the departing shadows, Osugi became conscious of a hand on the back of her obi.
"Thief!"
she shrieked as she made a grab for the pickpocket's wrist. But her coin purse had already been removed, and the thief was already in the street.
"Thief!"
Osugi screamed again. Flying after the man, she managed to throw her arms around his waist.
"Help! Thief!"
The pickpocket struggled, striking her several times in the face without being able to break her grip.
"Let go of me, you cow!"
he shouted, kicking her in the ribs. With a loud grunt, Osugi fell down, but she had her short sword out and slashed at the man's ankle.
"Ow!"
Blood pouring from the wound, he limped a few steps, then flopped down on the ground. Startled by the commotion, the land dealers turned around, and one of them exclaimed,
"Hey, isn't that good-for-nothing from Koshu?"
The speaker was Hangawara Yajibe, master of a large gang of construction workers.
"Looks like him," agreed one of his henchmen. "What's that in his hand? Looks like a purse."
"It does, doesn't it? And somebody just yelled thief. Look, there's an old woman sprawled out on the ground. Go see what's the matter with her. I'll take care of him."
The pickpocket was on his feet and running again, but Yajibe caught up with him and slapped him to the ground as he might have swatted a grasshopper. Returning to his boss, the henchman reported,
"Just as we thought, he stole the old lady's purse.
I have it here. How is she?"
"Not hurt bad. She fainted, but came to screaming bloody murder."
"She's still sitting there. Can't she stand up?"
"I guess not. He kicked her in the ribs."
"You son of a bitch!"
Still glaring at the pickpocket, Yajibe issued a command to his underling.
"Ushie, put up a stake!"
The words set the thief to trembling as though the point of a knife were being pressed against his throat.
"Not that,"
he pleaded, groveling in the dirt at Yajibe's feet.
"Let me off just this once. I promise I won't do it again."
Yajibe shook his head.
"Nope! You'll get what you deserve."
Ushi, who had been named after the zodiac sign under which he was born, a not uncommon practice among farmers, returned with two workmen from the nearby bridge site.
"Over there,"
he said, pointing toward the middle of a vacant lot. After the workmen had driven a heavy post into the ground, one of them asked,
"This good enough?"
"That's fine," said Yajibe. "Now tie him to it and nail a board above his head."
When this had been done, Yajibe borrowed a carpenter's inkpot and brush and wrote on the board,
"This man is a thief. Until recently he worked for me, but he has committed a crime for which he must be punished. He is to be tied here, exposed to rain and sun, for 7 days and 7 nights, by order of Yajibe of Bakurocho."
"Thanks," he said, returning the inkpot. "Now, if it's not too much trouble, give him a bite to eat every once in a while. Just enough to keep him from starving. Anything left over from your lunch will do."
The two workmen, along with others who had congregated in the meantime, signified their assent. Some of the laborers promised that they would see to it that the thief got his share of ridicule. It wasn't just samurai who feared public exposure of their misdeeds or weaknesses. Even for ordinary townspeople in these times, to be laughed at was the worst of all punishments. Punishing criminals without reference to law was a firmly established practice. In the days when the warriors were too busy with warfare to maintain order, townsmen had, for the sake of their own safety, taken it upon themselves to deal with miscreants. Though Edo now had an official magistrate and a system was developing whereby leading citizens in each district functioned as government representatives, the summary administration of justice still occurred. With conditions still being a bit chaotic, the authorities saw little reason to interfere.
"Ushi," said Yajibe, "take the old lady her purse. Too bad this had to happen to somebody her age. She seems to be all alone. What happened to her kimono?"
"She says she washed it and hung it up to dry."
"Go get it for her, then bring her along. We might as well take her home with us. There's little point in punishing the thief if we're going to leave her here for some other ruffian to prey on."
Moments later, Yajibe strode away. Ushi was close behind, the kimono over his arm and osugi on his back. They soon reached Nihonbashi, the bridge of Japan, from which all distances along the roads leading out of Edo were now measured. Stone parapets supported the wooden arch, and since the bridge had been constructed only about a year before, the railings still preserved a feeling of newness. Boats from Kamakura and Odawara were moored along one riverbank. On the other was the city's fish market.
"Oh, my side hurts," Osugi said with a loud groan.
The fishmongers looked up to see what was going on. Being gaped at was not to Yajibe's liking. Glancing back at Osugi, he said,
"We'll be there soon. Try to hold on. Your life's not in danger."
Osugi laid her head on Ushi's back and became as quiet as a baby. In the downtown area, tradesmen and artisans had formed their own neighborhoods. There was a blacksmith district, one for lamps makers, others for dyers, tatami weavers, and so on. Yajibe's house stood out prominently from those of the other carpenters because the front half of the roof was covered with tiles. All the other houses had board roofs. Until a fire a couple of years before, nearly all the roofs had been made of thatch. As it happened, Yajibe had acquired what passed for his surname from his roof, Hangawara, meaning half-tiled. He had come to Edo as a ronin, but being both clever and warm-hearted, he had proved to be a skillful manager of men. Before long, he set himself up as a contractor, employing a sizable crew of carpenters, roofers, and unskilled workers. From building projects carried out for various daimyo, he acquired enough capital to branch out into the real estate business as well. Too affluent now to have to work with his own hands, he played the role of local boss. Among Edo's numerous self-appointed bosses, Yajibe was one of the best known and most highly respected. The townspeople looked up to the bosses as well as to the warriors, but of the two, the bosses were the more highly admired, because they usually stood up for the common people. Although those of Edo had a style and spirit of their own, the bosses were not unique to the new capital. Their history went back to the troubled latter days of the Ashikaga shogunate, when gangs of thugs roamed the countryside like prides of lions, pillaging at will and submitting to no restraints. According to a writer of that era, they wore little more than vermilion loincloths and wide stomach wrappers. Their long swords were very long, nearly 4 feet, and even their short swords were more than 2 feet in length. Many used other weapons of a cruder type, such as battle axes and iron rakes. They let their hair grow wild, using thick strips of rope for headbands, and leather leggings often covered their calves. Having no fixed loyalties, they operated as mercenaries, and after peace was restored, were ostracized by both farmers and samurai alike. By the Edo era, those not content with being bandits or highwaymen often sought their fortunes in the new capital. More than a few succeeded, and this breed of leaders was once described as having righteousness for bones, love of the people for flesh, and gallantry for skin. In short, they were popular heroes par excellence. Slaughter by the Riverside. Life under Yajibe's half-tiled roof agreed so much with Osugi that a year and a half later she was still there. After the first few weeks, during which she rested and recovered her health, hardly a day passed without her telling herself she should be on her way. Whenever she broached the subject to Yajibe, whom she didn't see often, he urged her to stay on.
"What's the hurry?" he would ask. "There's no reason for you to go anywhere. Bide your time until we find Musashi. Then we can serve as your seconds."
Yajibe knew nothing of Osugi's enemy except what she herself had told him, that he was, in so many words, the blackest of blackguards. But since the day of her arrival, all of his men had been under instructions to report immediately anything they heard or saw of Musashi. After initially detesting Edo, Osugi had mellowed in attitude to the point where she was willing to admit that the people were friendly, carefree, and really very kind at heart. The Hangawara household was a particularly easygoing place and something of a haven for social misfits. Country boys too lazy to farm, displaced ronin, profligates who had run through their parents' money, and tattooed ex-convicts made up a coarse and motley crew, whose unifying esprit de corps curiously resembled that of a well-run school for warriors. The ideal here, however, was blustering masculinity rather than spiritual manliness. It was really a dojo for thugs. As in the martial arts dojo, there was a rigid class structure. Under the boss, who was the ultimate temporal and spiritual authority, came a group of seniors, usually referred to as the elder brothers. Below them were the ordinary henchmen, the kobun, whose ranking was determined largely by length of service. There was also a special class of guests. Their status depended on such factors as their ability with weapons. Bolstering the hierarchical organization was a code of etiquette of uncertain origin but strictly adhered to. At one point, Yajibe, thinking Osugi might be bored, suggested that she take care of the younger men. Since then, her days had been fully occupied with sewing, mending, washing, and straightening up after the kobun, whose slovenliness gave her plenty of work. For all their lack of breeding, the kobun recognized quality when they saw it. They admired both Osugi's Spartan habits and the efficiency with which she went about her chores.
"She's a real samurai lady," they were wont to say. "The house of Honiden must have very good blood in it."
Osugi's unlikely host treated her with consideration and had even built her separate living quarters on the vacant lot behind his house. And whenever he was at home, he went to pay his respects each morning and evening. When asked by one of his underlings why he displayed such deference toward a stranger, Yajibe confessed that he had acted very badly toward his own father and mother while they were still alive.
"At my age," he said, "I feel I have a filial duty to all older people."
Spring came, and the wild plum blossoms fell, but the city itself had as yet almost no cherry blossoms. Apart from a few trees in the sparsely settled hills to the west, there were only the saplings that Buddhists had planted along the road leading to the Sensoji in Asakusa. Rumor had it that this year they were sprouting buds and would blossom for the first time. One day Yajibe came to Osugi's room and said,
"I'm going to the Sensoji. Do you feel like coming along?"
"I'd love to. That temple's dedicated to Kanzeong, and I'm a great believer in her powers. She's the same bodhisattva as the Kannon I prayed to at Kiyomizu-dera in Kyoto."
With Yajibe and Osugi went two of the kobun, Judo and Koroku. Judo bore the nickname Reed Mat, for reasons no one knew, but it was obvious why Koroku was called the Acolyte. He was a small, compact man with a distinctly benign face, if one overlooked the three ugly scars on his forehead, evidence of a proclivity for street brawls. They first made their way to the moat at Kyobashi, where boats were available for hire. After Koroku had skillfully sculled them out of the moat and into the Sumida River, Yajibe ordered the box lunches opened.
"I'm going to the temple today," he explained, "because it's the anniversary of my mother's death. I really should go back home and visit her grave, but it's too far, so I compromise by going to the Sensoji and making a donation. But that's neither here nor there. Just think of it as a picnic."
He reached over the side of the boat, rinsed off a sake cup, and offered it to Osugi.
"It's very fine of you to remember your mother," she said as she accepted the cup, all the while wondering fretfully if Matahachi would do the same when she was gone. "I wonder, though, is drinking sake on the anniversary of your poor mother's passing the thing to do?"
"Well, I'd rather do that than hold some pompous ceremony. Anyway, I believe in the Buddha. That's all that counts for ignorant louts like me. You know the saying, don't you? He who has faith need have no knowledge."
Osugi, letting it go at that, proceeded to have several refills. After a time, she remarked,
"I haven't drunk like this for ages. I feel like I'm floating on air."
"Drink up," urged Yajibe. "It's good sake, isn't it? Don't worry about being out on the water. We're here to take care of you."
The river, flowing south from the town of Sumida, was broad and placid. On the Shimosa side, the east bank opposite Edo, stood a luxuriant forest. Tree roots jutting into the water formed nests holding limpid pools, which shone like sapphires in the sunlight.
"Oh," said Osugi, "listen to the nightingales."
"When the rainy season comes, you can hear cuckoos all day long."
"Let me pour for you. I hope you don't mind my joining in your celebration."
"I like to see you having a good time."
From the stern, Koroku called out lustily,
"Say, boss, how about passing the sake around?"
"Just pay attention to your work. If you start now, we'll all drown. On the way back, you can have all you want."
"If you say so. But I just want you to know the whole river's beginning to look like sake."
"Stop thinking about it. Here, pull over to that boat next to the bank so we can buy some fresh fish."
Koroku did as he was told. After a bit of haggling, the fisherman, flashing a happy smile, lifted the cover off a tank built into the deck and told them to take anything they wanted. Osugi had never seen anything like it. The tank was full to the brim with wriggling, flapping fish, some from the sea, some from the river. Carp, prawns, catfish, black porgies, gobies, even trout and sea bass. Yajibe sprinkled soy sauce on some whitebait and began eating it raw. He offered some to Osugi, but she declined with a look of dread on her face. When they drew up on the west side of the river and disembarked, Osugi seemed a little wobbly on her feet.
"Be careful," warned Yajibe. "Here, take my hand."
"No, thank you. I don't need any help."
She waved her own hand before her face indignantly. After Judo and Koroku had moored the boat, the four of them crossed a broad expanse of stones and puddles to get to the riverbank proper. A group of small children were busily turning over stones, but seeing the unusual foursome, they stopped and flocked around, chattering excitedly.
"Buy some, sir, please. Won't you buy some, Granny?"
Yajibe seemed to like children. At least, he showed no signs of annoyance.
"What have you got there? Crabs?"
"Not crabs, arrowheads," they cried,
producing handfuls of them from their kimonos.
"Arrowheads?"
"That's right. A lot of men and horses are buried in a mound by the temple. People coming here buy arrowheads to offer to the dead. You should, too."
"I don't think I want any arrowheads, but I'll give you some money." How'll that do?
That, it appeared, would do admirably, and as soon as Yajibe had passed out a few coins, the children ran off to resume their digging. But even as he watched, a man emerged from a thatched roof house nearby, took the coins away from them, and went back inside. Yajibe clicked his tongue and turned away in disgust. Osugi was gazing out over the river, fascination in her eyes.
"If there are a lot of arrowheads lying around," she observed, "there must have been a big battle."
"I don't really know, but it seems there were quite a few battles here in the days when Edo was only a provincial estate. That was 400 or 500 years ago. I've heard that Minamoto no Yoritomo came up here from Izu to organize troops in the 12th century, when the imperial court was divided. When was that? 14th century? Lord Niita of Musashi was defeated by the Ashikagas somewhere in the neighborhood. Just in the last couple of centuries, Ota Dokan and other local generals are said to have fought many battles not far up the river."
While they were talking, Judo and Koroku went on ahead to make a place for them to sit on the veranda of the temple. The Sensoji turned out to be a terrible disappointment to Osugi. In her eyes, it was nothing more than a large, run-down house, the priest's residence a mere shack.
"Is this it?"
she wanted to know, with more than a hint of deprecation.
"After all I've heard about the Sensoji..."
The setting was a splendidly primeval forest of large, ancient trees, but not only did the Kanzeon Hall look shabby, when the river flooded, the water came through the woods right up to the veranda. Even at other times, small tributaries washed over the grounds.
"Welcome! Good to see you again!"
Glancing up in surprise, Osugi saw a priest kneeling on the roof.
"Working on the roof?"
asked Yajibe amiably.
"Have to, because of the birds. The oftener I mend it, the oftener they steal the thatch to make nests with. There's always a leak somewhere. Make yourselves comfortable. I'll be down shortly."
Yajibe and Osugi picked up votive candles and went into the dim interior.
"No wonder it leaks," she thought,
looking at the star-like holes above her. Kneeling beside Yajibe, she took out her prayer beads and, with a dreamy look in her eye, chanted the vow of Kanzeon from the Lotus Sutra.
"You will reside in the air like the sun, and if you are pursued by evil men and pushed off the Diamond Mountain, reflect on the power of Kanzeon, and you will not lose a hair from your head. And if bandits surround you and threaten you with swords, if you reflect on the power of Kanzeon, the bandits will take pity on you. And if the king sentences you to death, and the sword is about to behead you, reflect on the power of Kanzeon. The sword will break into pieces."
She recited softly at first, but as she became oblivious to the presence of Yajibe, Judo, and Koroku, her voice rose and grew resonant. A rapt expression came to her face.
"The 84,000 sentient beings began to aspire in their hearts for Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi, the unsurpassed wisdom of the Buddhas."
Prayer beads trembling in her fingers, Osugi went without a break from the recitation into a personal supplication of her own.
"Hail to Kanzeon, world-honored one! Hail to the Bodhisattva of infinite mercy and infinite compassion. Look favorably on this old woman's one wish. Let me strike Musashi down, and very soon, let me strike him down. Let me strike him down."
Abruptly lowering her voice, she bowed to the floor.
"And make Matahachi a good boy. Cause the house of Honniden to prosper."
After the long prayer ended, there was a moment's silence before the priest invited them outside to have some tea. Yajibe and the two younger men, who had knelt in proper fashion throughout the invocation, got up rubbing their tingly legs and went out on the veranda.
"I can have some sake now, can't I?"
Judo asked eagerly. Permission having been granted, he hastened to the priest's house and arranged their lunch on the porch. By the time the others joined him, he was sipping sake with one hand and broiling the fish they had bought with the other.
"Who cares if there aren't any cherry blossoms?" he remarked. "Feels just like a flower-viewing picnic anyway."
Yajibe handed the priest an offering, delicately wrapped in paper, and told him to use it for the roof repairs. As he did so, he happened to notice a row of wooden plaques on which were written donors' names, together with the amounts they had contributed. Nearly all were about the same as Yajibe's, some less, but one stood out conspicuously. 10 gold coins, Daizo of Narai, province of Shinano. Turning to the priest, Yajibe remarked somewhat diffidently,
"Perhaps it's crass of me to say so, but 10 gold coins is a considerable sum. Is this Daizo of Narai as rich as all that?"
"I really couldn't say. He appeared out of the blue one day toward the end of last year and said it was a disgrace that the most famous temple in the Kanto district was in such bad shape. He told me the money should be added to our fund for buying lumber."
"Sounds like an admirable sort of man."
"He also donated 3 gold coins to Yushima Shrine and no fewer than 20 to Kanda Myojin Shrine. He wanted the latter to be kept in good condition because it enshrines the spirit of Taira no Masakado. Daizo insists that Masakado was not a rebel. He thinks he should be revered as the pioneer who opened up the eastern part of the country. You'll find there are some very unusual donors in this world."
Hardly had he finished speaking when a crowd of children came running helter-skelter toward them.
"What are you doing here?" shouted the priest sternly. "If you want to play, go down by the river. You mustn't run wild in the temple grounds."
But the children swept on like a school of minnows until they reached the veranda.
"Come quick," cried one. "It's awful. There's a samurai down there. He's fighting. One man against 4. Real swords." "Praise to Buddha, not again," lamented the priest as he hurriedly slipped on his sandals.
Before running off, he took a moment to explain,
"Forgive me. I'll have to leave you for a while. The riverbank is a favorite place for fights. Every time I turn around, somebody's down there cutting people to pieces or beating them to a pulp. Then men from the magistrate's office come to me for a written report. I'll have to go see what it is this time."
"A fight?"
chorused Yajibe and his men, and off they raced. Osugi followed, but was so much slower on her feet that by the time she got there, the fight was over. The children and some onlookers from a nearby fishing village all stood around in silence, swallowing hard and looking pale. At first, Osugi thought the silence strange, but then she, too, caught her breath and her eyes opened wide. Across the ground flitted the shadow of a swallow. Walking toward them was a young, smug-faced samurai clad in a purplish red warrior's cloak. Whether or not he noticed the spectators, he paid them no heed. Osugi's gaze shifted to 4 bodies lying in a tangle some 20 paces behind the samurai. The victor paused. As he did so, a low gasp went up from several lips, for one of the vanquished had moved. Struggling to his feet, he cried,
"Wait! You can't run away!"
The samurai assumed a waiting stance while the wounded man ran forward, gasping,
"This fight's not over yet!"
When he leapt weakly to the attack, the samurai retreated a step, allowing the man to stumble forward. Then he struck. The man's head split in 2.
"Now is it over?"
he shouted viciously. No one had even seen the drying pole drawn. Having wiped off his blade, he stooped to wash his hands in the river. Though the villagers were accustomed to fights, they were astonished at the samurai's sang-froid. The last man's death had been not only instantaneous, but inhumanly cruel. Not a word was uttered. The samurai stood up and stretched.
It's just like the Iwakuni River, he said. Reminds me of home.
For a few moments, he gazed idly at the wide stream and a flock of white-bellied swallows swooping and skimming the water. Then he turned and walked rapidly downstream. He made straight for Yajibe's boat, but as he began untying it, Judo and Koroku came running out of the forest.
Wait! What do you think you're doing?
Shouted Judo, who was now close enough to see the blood on the samurai's hakama and sandal thongs, but took no notice of it. Dropping the rope, the samurai grinned and asked,
Can't I use the boat? Of course not,
snapped Judo.
Suppose I paid to use it.
Don't talk nonsense!
The voice brusquely refusing the samurai's request was Judo's, but in a sense, it was the whole brash new city of Edo speaking fearlessly through his mouth. The samurai did not apologize, but neither did he resort to force. He turned and walked off without another word.
Kojiro! Kojiro! Wait!
Osugi called at the top of her lungs. When Kojiro saw who it was, the grimness vanished from his face, and he broke into a friendly smile.
Why? What are you doing here? I've been wondering what happened to you. I'm here to pay my respects to Kanzeon. I came with Hangawara Yajibe and these two young men. Yajibe is letting me stay at his house in Bakurocho.
When was it I saw you last? Let's see, Mount Hiei. You said then you were going to Edo, so I thought I might run into you. I hardly expected it to be here.
He glanced at Judo and Koroku, who were in a state of shock.
You mean those two there? Oh, they're just a couple of ruffians, but their boss is a very fine man.
Yajibe was just as thunderstruck as everybody else to see his guest chatting amiably with the awesome samurai. He was on the spot in no time, bowing to Kojiro and saying,
I'm afraid my boys spoke very rudely to you, sir. I hope you'll forgive them. We're just ready to leave. Perhaps you'd like to ride downstream with us?
Shavings. Like most people thrown together by circumstance, who ordinarily have little or nothing in common, the samurai and his host soon found mutual ground. The supply of sake was plentiful, the fish fresh, and Osugi and Kojiro had an odd spiritual kinship that kept the atmosphere from getting stickily formal. It was with genuine concern that she inquired about his career as a shugyosha, and he about her progress in achieving her great ambition. When she told him she'd had no word of Musashi's whereabouts for a long time, Kojiro offered a ray of hope.
I heard a rumor that he visited two or three prominent warriors last fall and winter. I have a hunch he's still in Edo.
Yajibe wasn't so sure, of course, and told Kojiro that his men had learned absolutely nothing. After they had discussed Osugi's predicament from every angle, Yajibe said,
I hope we can count on your continued friendship.
Kojiro responded in the same vein and made rather a display of rinsing out his cup and offering it not only to Yajibe, but to his two minions, for each of whom he poured a drink. Osugi was positively exhilarated.
They say, she observed gravely, that good is to be found whenever one looks. Even so, I'm exceptionally lucky. To think that I have two strong men like you on my side. I'm sure the great Kanzeon is looking after me.
She made no attempt to conceal her sniffling or the tears that came to her eyes. Not wanting the conversation to get maudlin, Yajibe said,
Tell me, Kojiro, who were the four men you cut down back there?
This seemed to be the opportunity Kojiro had been waiting for, for his agile tongue set to work without delay.
Oh, them,
he began with a nonchalant laugh.
Just some ronin from Obata's school. I went there 5 or 6 times to discuss military matters with Obata, and those fellows kept butting in with impertinent remarks. They even had the nerve to spout off on the subject of swordsmanship. So I told them that if they'd come to the banks of the Sumida, I'd give them a lesson in the secrets of the Gundyu style, along with a demonstration of the dying pole's cutting edge. I let them know I didn't care how many of them came. When I got there, there were 5 of them, but the minute I took a stance, 1 turned tail and ran. I must say, Edo has no shortage of men who talk better than they fight.
He laughed again, this time boisterously.
Obata?
You don't know him? Obata Kagenori. He comes from the lineage of Obata Nichijo, who served the Takeda family of Kai. Ieyasu took him on, and now he's a lecturer in military science to the shogun Hidetada. He also has his own school.
Oh yes, I remember now.
Yajibe was surprised and impressed by Kojiro's apparent familiarity with such a celebrated person.
The young man still has his forelock, he marveled to himself, but he must be somebody if he associates with samurai of that rank.
The carpenter boss was, after all, a simple soul, and the quality he most admired in his fellow man was clearly brute strength. His admiration for Kojiro intensified. Leaning toward the samurai, he said,
"Let me make you a proposition. I've always got 40 or 50 young louts lying around my house. How would it be if I built a dojo for you and asked you to train them?"
"Well, I wouldn't mind giving them lessons, but you must understand that so many daimyo are tugging at my sleeve with offers, 2,000-3,000 bushels, that I don't know what to do. Frankly, I wouldn't seriously consider going into anyone's service for less than 5,000. Also, I'm rather obligated, just for the sake of courtesy, to stay where I'm living now. Still, I've no objection to coming to your place."
With a low bow, Yajibe said, "I'd greatly appreciate that." Osugi chimed in,
"We'll be expecting you."
Juro and Koroku, far too naive to recognize the condescension and self-serving propaganda lacing Kojiro's speech, were bowled over by the great man's largesse. When the boat rounded the turn into the Kyobashi moat, Kojiro said,
"I'll be getting off here."
He then leapt onto the bank and in a matter of seconds was lost in the dust hovering over the street.
"Very impressive young man," said Yajibe, still under the spell.
"Yes,"
Osugi agreed with conviction.
"He's a real warrior. I'm sure plenty of daimyo would pay him a handsome stipend."
After a moment's pause, she added wistfully,
"If only Matahachi were like that."
About 5 days later, Kojiro breezed into Yajibe's establishment and was ushered into the guest room. There, the 40 or 50 henchmen on hand paid their respects, one by one. Kojiro, delighted, remarked to Yajibe that he seemed to lead a very interesting life. Pursuing his earlier idea, Yajibe said,
"As I told you, I'd like to build a dojo. Would you care to take a look at the property?"
The field in back of the house measured nearly 2 acres. Freshly dyed cloth hung in one corner, but Yajibe assured Kojiro the dyer he had rented the plot to could easily be evicted.
"You don't really need a dojo," observed Kojiro. "The area is not open to the street. No one's likely to intrude."
"Whatever you say, but what about rainy days?"
"I won't come if the weather's bad. I should warn you, though, the practice sessions will be rougher than the ones held by the Yagyu or other schools around town. If your men aren't careful, they might wind up crippled or worse. You'd better make that clear to them."
"There'll be no misunderstanding about that. Feel free to conduct classes as you see fit."
They agreed on having lessons 3 times a month, on the 3rd, the 13th, and the 23rd, weather permitting. Kojiro's appearances in Bakurocho were a source of endless gossip. One neighbor was heard to say,
"Now they've got a show-off over there worse than all the others put together."
His boyish forelock also came in for considerable comment, the general opinion being that since he must be in his early 20s, it was high time he conformed to the samurai practice of shaving his pate. But only those inside the Hangawara house were treated to the sight of Kojiro's brightly embroidered underrobe, which they got to see every time he bared his shoulder to give his arm free play. Kojiro's demeanor was quite what might be expected, though this was practice and many of his students